last week, because it's going to play into this big time. 1 Samuel 4, you recall that they were out fighting the Philistines, and they decided they would get the ark, and if they took the ark ahead of them, they would automatically win, right? Of course they'd win. They got the ark, and they didn't. They lost. They lost tremendously. We've seen that Eli's sons died, and then Eli himself died, and then the daughter-in-law actually gave birth to a child named Ichabod, and it was talking about it was that the glory of the Lord was now gone, and that was definitely symbolized because the ark of God, and we remember what this ark was, y'all. This was the epicenter, really, of their entire faith, because they thought that Moses, you know, he had given the Ten Commandments, the tablets, placed them in the ark, and it had always been in the Holy of Holies, even when it was traveling along as the tabernacle, as it was here, and then later when they build the temple, it's going to be there. It's going to be the thing that symbolizes God's presence. It was a very special artifact, and now it is stolen. This isn't just them taking some treasure. It's them taking the ultimate treasure, and it's going to be in the hands of the Philistines, and we're going to see how, even in the midst of all that, God remains undefeated. And so, follow along with me. We're going to read just the first few verses here in chapter 5, and we'll break it up. Each point, we'll continue reading. So keep your Bible open as we go through our points. But 1 Samuel 5, verse 1. Now when the Philistines captured the Ark of God, they brought it from Ebenezer to Ashdod. And then the Philistines took the Ark of God, and they brought it into the house of Dagon. And they set it up beside Dagon, and when the people of Ashdod rose early the next day, behold, Dagon had fallen face downward on the ground before the ark of the Lord. So they took Dagon and put him back in his place. But when they rose early on the next morning, behold, Dagon had fallen face downward on the ground before the ark of the Lord, and the head of Dagon and both his hands were lying cut off on the threshold. Only the trunk of Dagon was left to him. And this is why the priest of Dagon and all who enter the house of Dagon do not tread on the threshold of Dagon in Ashdod to this day. Then the people of the Lord, then the hand of the Lord was heavy against the people of Ashdod, and he terrified and afflicted them with tumors, both Ashdod and its territory. And when the men of Ashdod saw how things were, they said, "The ark of the God of Israel must not remain with us, for his hand is hard against us and against Dagon, our God." Let's pray. Father, I ask that you speak now through your word in a way that only you can. And we'll thank you for it. And it's in Jesus' name we pray. Amen. Our first point is this. God's enemies never have been, nor never will be, equal to him. God's enemies never have been, nor never will be, equal to him. And so what do we see here? Well, I've already told you, the glory of the Lord was gone from the people of God, and the ark of the God was in the hands of the Philistines. But if you recall, I told you a little bit about how the Philistines thought about things. And in a sense, it wasn't their fault, right? They were pagans. They did not know God. And so they were just reasoning their way towards these things. And they were a lot like the Romans. You know, they would come up with different gods for this and gods for that. And they believed that gods were gods of regions. And so you had the god that was over this city and the god over that city. And so actually it was sort of in a very twisted way, because they didn't know God, it was sort of a very reverent thing for them to do, because they even thought that every one of their victories was because of their God. Boy, Israel could have learned something from that, right? Every now and then they got so full of themselves, they thought they were the strong ones, and the Philistines at least thought it was the God that conquered. And so they would beat the Israelites, and they did the only thing that seemed that made sense. Well, our God must be stronger than their God, so we'll make their God serve our God. And that's what it symbolized, right? They took the ark of God, and they took it into their temple. And they said, well, we'll set it here at the foot of Dagon, and now Yahweh, the God of Israel, the one true God, he's got to serve our God, because he's weak. He's a weakling. Well, they didn't know him, right? They're about to know him. They didn't know him, and they placed him there, and then something crazy happens, right? They show up the next morning after setting him in the temple, and you can imagine, this really seems like God's took a loss, doesn't it? See, that's one key. Go ahead and get that through your mind now. God never loses. He didn't lose against the Philistines. Remember last chapter, we were talking about the very fact that he was judging them, and so they lost. Right? If God had wanted to take out the Philistines, he could have done so without even using an Israelite army. But he didn't. So when they got captured, it wasn't as if God lost. He wasn't strong enough. He doesn't lose. He's undefeated, hence the title, right? And so we see that. He's in this pagan temple, and he's at the foot of this pagan god, this idol that's not even a real god. But when they show up the next day, what's their idol doing? Fall face downward. at the ark. Which is very interesting, right? Because what does that picture? It pictures a position of prostrate worship, right? His face is down on the ground. You think your God's so great, Philistines, and your God's worshiping our God, right? He's not even worthy. And so they find him face downward. And it's pretty, you might want to think about this, right? I don't know why the Philistines didn't. If you have to come in and put your God back in his place, probably not a very good God. And sometimes people think we have to do that even with our God. We don't. There's nothing that we can do to control him, and there's no form or fashion in which we're putting him back. We don't have a dumb idol. We have a true and living God, one that's alive. But they had to put their God back in his place, and they decided, well, it must have been a fluke. And, well, next morning, same thing. Face down, but this time he even got a head. Right? They cut the head and the feet off, and they were sitting on the threshold of the ark. Now, you got to think, boy, what happened in that picture? I don't know. Right? I mean, I know obviously the statue lost its head. Whether it was angels or what, we don't know. It was overnight, but something took that head off that statue and had it sitting on the side. And when they came in and seen it, they realized, wow, not only does our God no match for this God, our God's slain. Their God's slain our God. He cut his head off. Why? Because he ain't nothing but a statue. That's what the problem is with fabricating our own gods. Whether we make them into a statue or we build them up here in our heads. You can build it all you want, but it falls apart. It comes to pieces. It's not real. The only real God is the one that we see in the scriptures. And so they realize that, and they say even to this day, the priests won't step on the threshold because that's where the head of their God was. And then something more happens. They begin to get afflicted with tumors. Now, we know from the next chapter, we'll see a little bit of this, that they send, they make, this sounds real appetizing, they make golden idols out of tumors and rats. And you'll see that. Right? And they form it into the shape of a rat. And because of that, people think that what these tumors were likely due to an infestation of rats. They think they had a rat infestation that God brought on that also brought about tumors that would pop up all over their bodies. And so these Philistines were dealing with that, and they immediately finally figured it out. They said, we got to get rid of this thing. His hand is hard against us. We thought we had the best spoil of war that you could ever come away with, but we got to get rid of it. This God's actually alive. They probably ain't used to that, right? They're used to going in and seeing the statue. And this one's actually making things happen. Now, one interesting side note, and I think this is awesome about God. Even in this, he showed mercy to the Philistines. How? Well, if you recall, the Israelites knew God. And we'll see this even in near the end of this story. They knew God. And there were certain directions about that ark, right? Don't touch it. A guy touches it and he drops dead. Meanwhile, we got these Philistines handling it like it's another piece of treasure, and God doesn't kill them all. Why? Because he cares for them. Even in their lost stage, God had mercy on them. Yeah, they got tumors, they were afflicted, but they didn't die. Right, this was God showing patience even with a pagan nation that didn't know him. But see, we see here that God's enemies never have been nor never will be equal to him. Dagon really didn't stand a chance. There wasn't anybody that was stronger than him. Today, there are people, and this is just one area, but there are people that in the name of science think that they're stronger than God. Right? That they think they can crucify him on the altar of science and so that we can disprove God. And you know how absolutely just completely disrespectful that is, because think about it for just for a minute. That is creatures using creation to try to disprove a creator. That's like the epitome of disrespect, and yet it happens all the stinking time. Right? We have people, you hear it in school some, I know the students hear it some, I've had students that are in college now that call me and they'll ask me, they're dealing with stuff with a biology teacher and all this and having lots of problems with the teacher, not that they're shaking on their faith. And I tell them this. Sometimes you'll see many scientists say things, and what's crazy is they're not even speaking about facts. They're speaking about theories. Because they think that God can't even be an option. Right? So if God's not an option, then we got to figure out how this thing works. Well, you can come out with some weird theories. If I'm lying, I'm dying. This is one of the theories, right? One of the theories, and I'm not just making fun of this to make fun of them, but I would like to. One of the theories was that out in the universe, way millions of years ago, There was something, now they wouldn't write this because it sounds childish, but that's what it was. There was a great big bubble machine. And the bubble machine just started spitting out bubbles until bubbles collided, and now we have everything we have now. Boy, that sounds believable, right? No, that's the kind of stuff that happens when you can't have a God. You just start chasing after all these dumb idols and dumb ideas, trying to make sense of it all, failing to realize that there's nothing here on this creation that we have to be worried about disproving our Creator. Why? Because He made it. It's His handiwork. It's His. And yet, sometimes people stand up and they think, well, we're a formidable enemy. And the reason I'm bringing that up is because there's some on science, there's some in politics, there's all these different areas where people push themselves up as enemies to the faith. And the thing is, if you look at the headlines, what's going to happen? You're going to get discouraged pretty quickly, right? You should, just thinking surface level, you should get kind of discouraged. You start thinking, my goodness, look at all these people that are fighting against God, that have all these problems with Him. How in the world, what do I have to say to that? Boy, this one's going to hell in a handbasket. Right, that might be some of the things we say and all the things that run through our mind. But I love what Spurgeon said concerning this text. He said, whenever infidelity or superstition prevails so as to discourage our minds, we may take comfort out of this, that God will protect His name. God will protect His name. What does that mean? It means this very point here in the beginning of Philistines, the point I have in the title of this message, we don't have to worry about God taking losses. If you look at the news headlines, you're going to think God's taking losses all the time, and you might think, well, I got to do something about that. Well, there is a sense in which we do need to stand up and represent Him, but one thing we need to always remember is that God doesn't lose. Right, there's never anybody that's been equal to Him. I love when you're scrolling through on like Facebook. It ain't there much anymore, and I'm glad, because it was, I won't be too polite. It was just stupid. It was a stupid picture, and it would be a picture of God that I guess looked like a picture of Jesus that you'd see on hanging on a wall. And then there would be one of the devil. And what's weird is, you know, Jesus, he was the guy that you see in pictures, and then the devil was the cartoon devil. Right, he had the red and the horns and pitchfork and all this stuff, and them two are staring at one another, and it's one of those weird dumb things where it says, like this photo if you stand with Jesus, and if you don't, you stand with Satan. Boy, that's how it works, right? Anyways, I see those stupid things, but what I don't like about them is it's almost like, oh, Jesus and the devil pitted against one another. Who's going to win? No! There's never been an enemy of God that's been equal to Him. Never was, never will be. Satan doesn't stand a chance. It ain't like he's another. This ain't Star Wars. There's not the dark side and the light side, and they're both equal forces working in everything. No, Star Wars is wrong on that one. There's Satan, who was even created by God. He's a creature, and he doesn't stand a chance. There's no sense in which we ever worry about he's going to win and we're going to lose. There's no ideas that are going to pop up in science. There's no philosophies that are going to come through universities. There's no political nation or anything that's going to make a move that's going to completely wipe out God and all of His followers. Why? Because God is God, and He will protect His name. Even when he's taken away by these Philistines, you would imagine Israel back there wringing their hands thinking, what are we going to do? What are we going to do? They got him. Well, we're going to see at the end of the story, they don't got him. But look what he's doing. He doesn't need anybody there, and he's taking off heads, knocking down statues, and giving everybody tumors. Why? Because we got to remember that we don't serve a dumb idol like Dagon who can fall down and have his head took off. We serve the God who's alive, that's greater than all of us, and even our strength he doesn't need. What does he need more than our strength? Our weakness, because he's going to be strong. He's the powerful one, not us, and he will protect his name. But not only do we see that, we're going to continue reading now in chapter 6. In chapter 6, look at verse 6. So I'll tell you what happens while we're getting there. They get rid of it, right? So if you're getting a bunch of tumors and you think it's caused by the golden box, you pass off the golden box. And so they passed it from city to city to city, and the same thing happened over and over again. Tumors came in, tumors came in, tumors came in. And so tumors were breaking out everywhere, and now it's in this city, and we're going to see what happens here in chapter 6, verses 6 through 9. We're going to read just a few verses there. They were all consulting, and then verse 6, why should you harden your hearts as the Egyptians and Pharaoh hardened their hearts, after he had dealt severely with them. Did they not send the people away and they departed? Now then, take and prepare a new cart and two milk cows on which there's never come a yoke, and yoke the cows to the cart, but take their calves home away from them. And take the ark of the Lord and place it on the cart and put it in a box at its sides, the figures of gold which you are returning to him as a guilt offering, and then send it off and let it go its way. And watch, if it goes up on the way to its land, to Beth Shemesh, then it is he who has done us this great harm. But if not, then we shall know that it is not his hand that struck us. It happened to us by coincidence. What do we see here? It's our second point. It's this, that God can work against all probability. God can work against all probability. Well, as I told you, the story continues, and what basically the Philistines are doing is they're playing hot potato with the ark. Pass it off, pass it off, pass it up. Maybe it'll be okay in this city, and then tumors break out. Get rid of it. Send it to the next person. And so when it gets here, this is finally where they call their priests, pagan priests, mind you. These sitting followers of God, but pagan priests, they're religious people. They call them all together, and they say, y'all, tell us what to do. We need some help. And this is where they instruct them to make, we didn't read it, but he instructs them to make idols out of gold, golden tumors and golden rats in order to send back as a guilt offering, symbolizing how God had afflicted them. And that's what it said when it said, put the box in the cart and then the figures of gold around it that you're going to be sending. That was it. But then what happens is they begin to give this plan. This is how we're going to get rid of this thing. We're going to do what the Egyptians didn't do. Now, that's an interesting thing, right? The Philistines knew about Egypt. Now, we knew that from 1 Samuel 4. Because if you remember in 1 Samuel 4, when the ark came in and everybody shouted and got real excited, the Philistines got scared and said, we remember what they did in Egypt. This God's pretty strong. So, isn't it interesting that, once again, the pagans making the Israelites look bad? Every time Israel had something big, they got so full of themselves, they wouldn't remember Egypt. They just try and do it. They get their butts whooped. And then a prophet would come and say, remember how God delivered us from Egypt? Y'all need to remember that. Why do we need to remember that? Because he's the source of strength. But the Philistines didn't forget that. The Philistines, they remember. They said, look, we don't want to be another Pharaoh. And I heard what happened to him. His army wiped out, him wiped out with the Red Sea. Here's what we'll do. And they got a crazy plan, and it is a wild plan. This is fun stories you have when you read the Old Testament, right? Get two milk cows that ain't ever pulled a cart, hook them up, make sure their calves are away from them, put the box on the cart, and let them go. And if the cows go to the land of the Israelites, God did it. And they can have it back, basically. And if it doesn't, we'll take it back real fast. We'll get the cows, and we'll just say, boy, this was a big coincidence. Which, come on, really? Tumor outbreaks, every city the thing goes. They're pretty sure this isn't a coincidence, and they're right. Right? This wasn't a coincidence, but that was their plan, that they were going to have this plan set in motion, and they're going to send them. And y'all, what happens? Well, you can probably already guess what happens. The cart didn't just go all the way to the border of that land and into that land. It makes a point in the text that say the cows did not even turn to the right or the left at all. The Philistines actually followed the cart all the way to the border, kind of hoping that, wouldn't you be sort of disheartened if you had this plan and all along you're thinking, boy, I really want that thing though. I hope this was all just a coincidence and the cows just take off as soon as you say go. And you're like, they are not turning. And you're looking, maybe they're chasing something to eat or something like that. And so they're following them the whole way. Maybe they'll turn back now. They got to stop and eat or something. Nope. They're dead set towards the land of Israel. And the Philistines were probably thinking, how'd this happen? Well, you know what? Dagon had to be put back on the altar. Our God can drive a couple cows anywhere he wants to go. Right? And he can actually do way above and beyond that. But that's exactly what we have the picture here. They let him go, and he goes. That is not probable at all. Right? These were milk cows. These weren't ones that were going to be pulling carts ever. They're not even used to that. And then also, their babies were kept away from them. So you had all these things that could have played into factor, and these cows had never been there. Right? It wasn't like they were going home or anything. So for them to make that trip was against all probability, but our God can work against all probability. I remember when I was as a youth at Motlow Creek Baptist Church down in Campobello, and we had a youth pastor, and he was a boy. He was raised up in the church, and he was at North Greenville University, and he was doing a good job. And I think he's out in Tennessee now. But anyways, his name was Josh. And Josh, like I say, young guy in college, he had this problem where he started sweating too much at night. And when I say sweating at night, I'm not talking about like some of us that need to turn the fan on and kick a leg out. No, it was to the point where he was having to change his sheets. It was every night. Terrible, terrible sweats. And so he finally went to the doctor, and he found out he had cancer. Right? It was a symptom, and it was cancer. And he had a tumor, and I don't even remember exactly where it was affected. I just remember it was all in his intestines and his guts, and it was wrapped up. And we were there with him when he was doing this cancer treatments, and he lost his hair, and how I went through that entire process. And it finally came time where they said, well, we just got to do a surgery. I don't think it shrunk at all or not much, but we got to do the surgery to see what's going to happen. And they told us going in, the church, I remember we were meeting for youth, and the preacher came out and told us the update, and he said, they're not real optimistic because of the way that tumor is wrapped around everything. All right, so they're going to go try and get as much as they can out, and we'll just be praying. And I remember we were at church. It was a Wednesday evening or a Sunday evening. I can't remember which day, but it was an evening service. And we got the phone call after the surgery was over, and they came and told us. They said the doctor couldn't explain it. When he opened him up, everything that was wrapped around just sort of fell off. It unwrapped, fell off, and they were able to get it all. Everything after that was just going to be chemo just for the sake of hoping it stays away or making sure nothing was left lying. And his mama, I remember giving us that report, crying, and we heard about it. And you could say, coincidence, but I say miracle. Right. It was a miracle. We had prayed for it, and God did it. God can work against all probability. And so what does that mean? Not only do we have a God who never loses, and he's not got anything equal against him that's going to stand up against him, we don't really have to be discouraged by the news headlines. As discouraging as it is, we need to realize that our God does win. What can happen is sometimes people get so discouraged, they just get negative. I had this guy one time. He used to come to a church in North Carolina. He'd come, and he was always upset about something. And it wasn't at the church. It was something going on in the nation. But all he ever did was complain. He'd sit there and complain to you for 30 minutes to an hour. And I'm thinking, ooh, that ain't helping the gospel at all, right? That's basically saying, I give up, realizing that our God is one that doesn't lose. So we don't have to be discouraged to the point of not moving. But not only that, he's a God that can work and perform miracles. We talked about this a couple Wednesdays ago when we were going through Jonah. We were talking about him being eaten by the whale. Can you explain how he got eaten by a whale and live? Yep, God. Right? If God is the one that can do supernatural things, if we could explain it all, it wouldn't be very supernatural, would it? We'd just say, well, you know, the way the whale's insides are is that you could live for this amount of time and the acids wouldn't eat you. Well, tell me how Lazarus raises from the dead. Well, you know, don't know, right? There's nothing you can do to rise from the dead. Hey, how did he walk on water? Well, you know, the water density's just right and there's some stones in the right place. No, he performs miracles. He does things way beyond what we can think or imagine because he's the one that created it. God can do what he wants here, and he does. And then that means he can work against all probability. He can get rid of cancer. And I've heard many other stories like that before, some that wasn't about the surgery, but others that they had cancer screenings, they had cancer, they went back for cancer screenings, and they ain't got no pictures no more. Everything's gone. Spots are gone. Now, I say that, I'm a realist, but I'm also a Christian, right? And so what that means is I fully understand that oftentimes when there's terminal illnesses, God does not choose to heal, and that's not a question we necessarily know the answer to or understand. It's hard when someone's in their last stages to talk to them and to pray and try to give any sense of, you know what, he may not cure this. But you know, that's not necessarily the right question for us to ask. I think back to the book of Daniel. And if you remember what those boys said before they got tossed into that fiery furnace, they didn't say, well, we've prayed and we're 100% sure that when we jump in here, we're not going to die. No, rather it said, we believe our God is able to save us from the fire. But even if he doesn't, we won't bow down to you. So even in sickness, we know that ultimate healing and ultimate victory is found in eternity. That eternal life and the doing away with all the illnesses is really what we're looking forward to. And that if he doesn't necessarily heal right now and in this life, that is itself isn't a loss. It's still a win. Because to live is Christ and to die is gain. But all that being said, I know that God can work against all probability. I know that there's never a doctor's report that can be so bad that God is helpless. If you want a helpless God, you serve Dagon or somebody you make up in your head. If you want the all-powerful one that can do things beyond our probability, you serve ours. And what that means is, there's a comfort in that, right? That God doesn't lose, and that he can do all things. Now, whether or not he does that for me, that's up to him. But I do know what he's already done for me. Covered my sin debt. Made me a child of his. And told me that in him I have life and life everlasting. Abundant life and freedom. What more can I ask for? Nothing. Nothing. God can work against all probability. And that's the kind of God we want to serve. But then, finally, look at what happens in chapter 6 still. Look at verse 13. We'll read a few verses there and we'll jump down to verse 19. Verse 13, now the people of Beth Shemesh were reaping their wheat harvest in the valleys. And when they lifted up their eyes and saw the ark, they rejoiced to see it. The cart came into the field of Joshua of Beth Shemesh and it stopped there. A great stone was there. And they split up the wood of the cart and offered the cows as a burnt offering to the Lord. And the Levites took down the ark of the Lord and the box that was beside it, in which were the golden figures, and set them upon the great stone. And the men of Beth Shemesh offered burnt offerings and sacrifices on that day to the Lord. And when the five lords of the Philistines saw it, they returned that day to Ekron. But then look at verse 19. This is talking about the Israelites now. They've done all this, and then verse 19. And he struck some of the men of Beth Shemesh because they looked upon the ark of the Lord. He struck 70 men of them, and the people mourned because the Lord had struck the people with a great blow. Then the men of Beth Shemesh said, who is able to stand before the Lord, this holy God, and to whom shall he go up away from us? Now the story seems like it made it back, so it should be positive, right? And in a sense it is. The ark is returned. It's going to go to a land and rest until the day when it finally goes to where it's destined for. And there's going to be a temple and everything built. So the ark does return. But the story really ain't that much of a happy one. Right, they see it. They're out working in the fields. They see the cow pulling the ark. You can imagine what's going through their heads. Well, this is odd. And they rejoice. They go, they cut the wood up from the cart, they kill the cows as a sacrifice, they set the ark up on a stone and some sort of altar. And everything they do seems pretty holy, right? Seems pretty religious, seems like they were doing things probably the right way, except for the fact they knew God and they were not doing things the right way. Right, they got ahead of themselves, but they knew the rules about touching and then also acting irreverently toward it. It said that some of the men looked upon the ark, and what that pictures is if they would walk by and maybe even look into the ark, right? Things you were never supposed to do. They treated this ark irreverently. They didn't follow God's laws that he had given them, and they knew it, right? And what we say last week, talking about older siblings and younger siblings, you should know better. Right? They should know better. So they don't just get tumors and mice. They die. Many of the Israelites are killed because of the way they handled the Ark of the Covenant. And it says that the Israelites were so upset and said, who can stand against the Lord? Who can do this? He dealt us a mighty blow. And so not only do we have a God who never has an enemy that's equal to him and can do all things against all probability, but a third thing we need to realize is that God is not fooled by false religion. Is not fooled by false religion. A couple things were going on with Israel at this time. Number one, they still didn't fully understand what it meant to trust him and not trust in that box, realizing that the ark was only as awesome as God is, right? And it was only because he was the one working. And so they didn't have that type of faith, But number two, and we know this from other books and just from some history, they still had their other gods. They still worshipped other gods. They had their idols. They thought that if we just tag Israel along and we take Yahweh and mix it with this god and that god and this god, we'll be good. Failing to realize that that type of idol worship was directly opposed to God. Now, they knew it, but they didn't care. And what they had was a false religion. Something that looked good on the outside. Their worship looked good, but it was irreverent and empty. We talked about this a lot in 1 Samuel 4 when we talked about the danger of going through the motions. But I'll just say that one of the dangers of cultural Christianity in the West is a scary thing. What do I mean by cultural Christianity in the West? Well, I'm using the word West, talking about like all the West, so even some of Europe, even though Europe's changing. But if you ask most people, if you're a Christian, well, it also depends where you are now, right? If you're in the Bible Belt, the answer is probably going to be yes. If you're somewhere out like on the West Coast, the answer is probably going to be no, right? Or it wouldn't matter one way or the other. But if you're in the Middle East and someone asks you, are you a Christian? The answer is most certainly no, unless you really are one. Why? Because it cost them something. Right? When we say, hey, you a Christian? You know Jesus? We can say, oh yeah, just quit talking to me. Go away. Right? But you go to the Middle East, you say, are you a Christian? You got to really think about what your answer to that is. Why? Because it could cost you your life. Same thing in Asia. Right? There, following Christ isn't just the culture. So in one sense, it's awesome in America. We have the freedom and the comfortable faith to be able to say Christian, not Christian. It could go either way. And we could say Christian and go through the motions and it doesn't matter. But it's also one of our greatest failings. Why? Because we can hide behind. It doesn't matter. When over there, you profess Christ, pay with your life. You profess Christ, pay with your job. You profess Christ, pay with all the comforts that you have from your family. We're going to kick you out of it. You can't be a part of it anymore. And it cost them something. Now, I don't want us to go to that. I'm happy I live in America. But I'm fearful that there are so many people that go through the motions. Because there's churches meeting all across the nation today. The numbers are probably drastic compared to what we actually see in like how things work out in headlines. And so you got to ask yourself, if millions of Christians are gathering in America, and yet some of the same things we still see happening on the news happen, maybe there's not really millions of Christians gathering across America. Maybe there's millions of churchgoers gathering across America. And it makes us think that there's going to be a day when he comes and he separates the wheat from the tares and he says to many, depart from me, I never knew you. God is not fooled by false religion. If he's the awesome one who has no equal enemy, if he's the awesome one that can do things against all probability, then why do some think, man, he's probably easy enough to deceive? As long as I play the part. That's just not true.